While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon to you, Namibia, and to our faithful listeners joining us from around the world. Welcome to Eagle FM, where conversations count. I am your host, Dafa Happy Juju, and you are tuned into On The Radar News Analysis, your weekday deep dive into the issues shaping Namibia's economic, social, and governance landscape. Today is Thursday, the 7th of May, 2026, and as the nation continues to navigate a rapidly evolving social and economic environment, we once again turn our attention to the stories driving the national conversation. And this afternoon on The Radar, we unpack the developments that matter most, that is from government policy and economic performance to education, infrastructure, youth development, governance, and the social realities affecting communities across the country. And as always, we go beyond the headlines to examine the bigger picture. What's influencing the decisions being made today? How do these developments affect ordinary Namibians? And what do they mean for the future of our country? Now, right here on The Radar, we believe informed citizens build stronger society. And that's why we don't just report the news. We provide context, encourage critical thinking, and create space for meaningful national dialogue. So every weekday from 1300 hours to 1430, we bring you expert insights, informed analysis, archived sound, and your voice in the discussion, because in a world flooded with information, understanding remains essential. You can listen live across Eagle FM frequencies, stream us live via the Eagle FM website, or download the Eagle FM app. Also, stay connected via our WhatsApp channel for updates, discussions, and exclusive content. So wherever you are this afternoon, at work, on the road, at home, or listening from abroad, thank you for joining us. Stay informed, stay engaged, and stay part of the conversation. Because right here on The Radar, Namibia doesn't just listen. Namibia comes to think and interrogate issues. Let us get right into today's discussions. Government invested over 57 million Namibian dollars to tackle classroom congestion in Erongo region. The Namibian government has invested more than 57 million Namibian dollars in major school infrastructure projects in the Erongo region. As part of ongoing efforts to reduce classroom congestion and improve access to quality education, Minister of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Arts and Culture, Sanet Steenkamp, on Tuesday, visited key construction sites in Hentis Bay and Swakopmund to assess progress on the developments, which are expected to significantly improve learning conditions for hundreds of learners in the region. In Extension 7, Hentis Bay, the minister inspected the construction of a brand new school valued at 7.2 million Namibian dollars. Now, the project is aimed at expanding educational access in the rapidly growing coastal town and easing overcrowding in existing schools. Phase 1 of the project commenced in August 2024, while Phase 2 is scheduled for October 2025, with full implementation expected by October 2026. Now, once completed, the new schools are set to provide 12 classrooms, 2 science laboratories, a computer laboratory, an administration block, and ablution facilities. Now, the facility is expected to provide learners with more modern and exclusive learning environment while strengthening science and technology education in the area. The minister also visited the DRC settlement in Swakopmund, where a large large-scale primary and secondary school development worth approximately $15 million Namibian dollars is currently under construction. Now, this project is set to deliver 27 standard classrooms, 26 high school classrooms, science laboratories, computer laboratories, and administration blocks. The development is regarded as a critical for the DRC community, where many learners currently depend on overcrowded schools in surrounding areas. Now, once completed, the schools is said to be expected to improve access to education closer to home and ease pressure on existing institutions. Construction on the Swakopmund project is expected to be completed by the end of this year, that is being 2026. During the visit, Minister of Education Steenkamp urged regional leaders and education stakeholders to begin preparing for the operational phase by securing essential educational resources, including computers, laboratory equipment, and specialized teaching materials ahead of the school's completion. Now, the investment forms part of government's broader eco-commitment to strengthening education infrastructure nationwide and ensuring that every Namibian child has access to safe, modern, and quality learning environments. Now, with that being said, let's pause right here, take a trip to the Maka Place. We're back shortly to engage an analyst and educate and an educator as well to speak further on this news.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the I.
Welcome back, and now joining me telephonically is not economist, but analyst and educator as well, Saki Johannes. A very good afternoon to you, Johannes, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me.
Pleasure to always engage you, and I just promoted you to being an economist. I think you need to go back to school and add that economics title, right, since it's graduation season. Definitely. Okay, Saki, of course, you being an educator yourself and being a researcher yourself, we're talking about Ministry of Education and government as a whole making its investment within the education sector, constructing classrooms in Erongo region. Even so much as one phase of the project has been done already by local construction. What is your take on this investment in education? I think it's also been a conversation that has been ongoing, how we still need more schools to avoid overcrowding and of course also to provide employment for those teachers that are currently unemployed. What's your take on this?
I think it's a good investment, and I think that's a positive move that the government have taken to address this issue. And for me, it's a burning issue in this regard that, you know, we have overcrowded classrooms, but at the same time, we have unemployed teachers. So I think that's a positive move for as long as we are building more classes. And also, I think this will offer job opportunities to our unemployed teachers that are still in the streets with their qualifications. And I had a conversation yesterday with one of the graduates, and then she was like, graduation does not excite us anymore because, you know, you will graduate and then you go home for 4 or 5 years. So I think it's a positive move.
It's a positive move, hey? Quite a lot of money there, and they're starting off, I think, since the news is within Erongo region. You know, there's been quite some complaints also towards the east. Is it northern part of Namibia, Kavango East, Kavango West, grappling with a shortage of classrooms? How do you think the ministry is going to balance this out? And from what I hear, it's the intent to reduce congestion, improve access to quality education all throughout Namibia. But what do you think about this for now?
Yeah. Okay. That's a good question. If you look at our population, majority of the people are in urban areas. And we speak of Erongo now, you know, majority is one of, it's in town even. Those schools have been built in town. And then that's why we have a lot of people. I think it's quite unfortunate that maybe we did not start from the beginning of the problem. The problem is urbanization. So if we can start by developing rural areas, and then we can stop urbanization first, because the more we build classes at urban, at rural areas, some people will not attend those classes. They will leave those classes and then they will go attend classes in urban areas. So I think we have to start with that point of trying to develop urban areas, though I'm not saying we should neglect, trying to develop rural areas. Though I'm not saying we should neglect urban areas. However, now looking at the underdeveloped regions in Namibia, and Kavango is one of them, so I think those criticisms are also correct. However, maybe the ministry have a plan, because I think before you come up with a policy as a ministry, you must do research first. And then you will see where are the problems, and then you can see, okay, how can we solve these problems? I think for the sake of planning, for the sake of research, for the sake of policy, maybe they have a policy that, okay, let's start here in Erongo first, maybe because of the population, because of the need, but also let's not neglect Kavango and Namibian rural areas, because we have also our people there. In rural areas, and Kavango is one of the regions that are underdeveloped as far as we are talking about development in an independent Namibia.
Mm-hmm. Saki Jonas, quite another development is the construction of two science laboratories, in other science laboratories for the second project, as well as a computer laboratory. Now, remembering when I was doing my high school, I do remember we did use the laboratory, that one. I'm not so sure about computer laboratories, if schools are even making use of, especially those schools whom sometimes computers have been donated to them. I'm not so sure if they're really making use of those within even rural areas and even some urban areas. I mean, I know schools would... kids are not being taught computer. Now we're talking about we're talking about fifth industrialization here, and if we want the children at one point to really to get to that point where Namibia knows how to every other Namibian knows how to apply online as we move and transition away from handing out CVs by hand. What is your observation and what have you observed on ground in terms of computers? Teachers really, or is it really implemented, so to say, let's incorporate and teach learners about computer science?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think we have a subject that is called computer science. So this is where kids go, and then they go and study computer studies. They go and study computer. But the challenge that we have, or that I've seen, is that we have a challenge with teachers. Majority of our teachers, though some of them did computer, some of them did not do computer here and there. I think we have a challenge of the transformation of knowledge, from a teacher to a learner as far as ICT is concerned, and the way they are doing it. Is it really productive, or they are just doing it because it's part of the syllabus, because it's part of their duty? Are these teachers passionate about teaching computer, or they are just teaching computer because that's where they got a job, or they have a job for the sake of, job opportunity? I think that's the challenge that we have, challenge number one. And spoken of the computer, I have also an experience at my school where I attended first secondary school. We had a computer lab, but I think in a term we only visited that room maybe two times. It wasn't a subject.
Yeah.
The computer skills. You know, we had the computer lab. And to make things funny, when we came to UNAM now, it's when we had computer literacy as a module. And now that computer literacy, those lecturers, they were struggling with some of us because I don't know what is a file. I don't know what's Microsoft Word. I don't know what's Microsoft Excel. I don't know how to create or to type in a Microsoft Word. So I have to start from a tertiary level. And now the other challenge, and which is funny, is that when you were told, when you registered and people say, okay, fine, you go to your portal and then you log in, there was a story where you can see how we have a low computer literacy rate in our country. The story was that some people went to look for a portal office. So they thought it's a certain office in the campus where you have to go, and the office is called portal, when you are just supposed to use Google and then you go to your portal.
Imagine.
So those are the challenges that we faced, especially people that attended school at rural areas. Computers are there, but I think the emphasis should be on, are they being used for the purposes that they are bought for? Because some computers, and sometimes not every kid that have access to those computers when they are supposed to have access to those computers. And also monitoring. Majority of our kids, they are not monitored when they are using those computers. The teacher will be there seated, and then they are using computer for other purposes when they are supposed to use the computers for educational purposes. I think those are some of the challenges.
Yeah, indeed. Now, of course, another challenge I think I would want to add is that I've observed some students coming to university, not knowing the basics of computer literacy. And I think that's what we're trying to cap. And so I think there's really a need to really emphasize that they put in the work out there. But yeah, now speaking still on education matters and education aspect, there's another, perhaps not necessarily related to this particular news, but there's also the aspect of a lot of Namibian teachers complaining and bringing to the forefront the matter of children's ill behavior in schools, and of course the ministry has put away corporal punishment. So what do you think, as somebody who obviously researches and somebody who is an educator self, how do you think perhaps this issue of ill behavior of learners in the schools can be addressed?
Yeah, well, that one is a critical one, because our government, the policy is obviously no corporal punishment, which is good, because sometimes, not all the times, that you have to use force or violence to solve problems. I think it protects the kids.
And yes, thank you. Sorry. Before you go to the next point, as you say, they protect the kids. You know, we're having a lot of common cases of mental health challenges, and you know, not everybody's able to really. Not everybody has emotional intelligence. I think some teachers might actually take out their stress on the children. But yeah, continue.
Okay. Yeah, so I think that's one of the challenges that now we are protecting kids, which is a good thing. It's part of children's rights, as far as the rights of children are concerned. And we had a lot of incidences. I think I'm supporting that because of the experience that I had, that some people back then left school because of corporal punishment, because they were being beaten by teachers. But they could have made it, maybe. So, but now the question is, what powers do teachers have in the classroom? I think that's where we have a big challenge. And also on the side of the power that you have in the classroom as a teacher, and that has to do, again, with class management. How do you manage your class? How do you control kids? Sometimes it's a challenge that teachers have, and I think there should be a discussion of what powers should teachers have as far as they are in the class. Because some kids, they can answer teachers the way they want, but teachers sometimes they feel powerless in the class. However, there are those other type of punishments that you can use, like maybe withdrawing some of the kids favorite thing. Let me say that kid is a soccer player and he likes playing soccer too much, and then they end up failing at this. So instead of beating them and whipping them that it's not allowed anymore, maybe you can say, okay, today you are not playing for soccer. However, the other challenge that teachers have is also, or are facing, is also parents. You know, there are those ununderstandable parents. Just a single mistake. You are trying to discipline the kid, and then the parent will come in and they will come for you. And sometimes they don't even listen to the whole story of why did I do such a thing, or why am I behaving this way? They will come and say, hey, why did you take my kid? My kid was supposed to be at soccer. Why is not my kid at soccer this time around? Why is he not at football? Football, why are you taking those privileges from him or her? Now, it's sometimes difficult to explain, but I think education stakeholders should come together and come up with a policy of how can we discipline kids. I know we have DCs, which is disciplinary committees at schools. We have school boards. We have all that. But sometimes there's no clear policy of what teachers should be or what is the power of a teacher in the class. That's not well explained. And I think that's where the government should look at. And this also, you know, this confusion and this clear policies sometimes lead to a failure rate, because now a teacher doesn't have power to punish, you can't do anything, and then it goes to learners and they'll be like, even if I'm not doing my homework, if I'm not, what will this teacher do? Yeah. There's nothing you can do sometimes, and then that only hinders their performances, not only that, it affects teachers' performances as well, but mostly the most negative, which is a long time effect, is on learners, because if this learner fails, then sometimes their life is in jeopardy, or their future doesn't look good anymore, and that also contributes to our national performance as far as national exams are concerned. I think we have the roof pole that we need to look up to there.
Quite interesting. Yeah, quite a loophole that needs to be addressed, and I think needs to be addressed as soon as. But nonetheless, Saki Jonas, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reading News Analysis. Always really a pleasure engaging you and tapping into your wealth of wisdom. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. And then we had it from researcher and educator Saki Johannes. For now, let's pause right here. Take a trip to the marketplace. This, of course, is On The Radar News Analysis.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo duto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge fada fanoa na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile ko mderewa nora etatu natu bali o etatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM. The eye.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the I. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6%, is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima. Don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. And for other news, student voices are taking center stage in the national conversation on the growing use of artificial intelligence in journalism. As young media practitioners and aspiring journalists continue to navigate the opportunities and ethical challenges presented by rapidly advancing technology. Speaking at the Government Information Sharing Center, students highlighted the importance of maintaining integrity, credibility, and professional ethics in an era where AI tools are increasingly being integrated into news production and digital communication. Now, while acknowledging the benefits of innovation and technology in modern journalism, many students expressed concern over the misuse of AI-generated content, misinformation, plagiarism, and the potential erosion of public trust in the media. The students emphasized that although AI can assist journalists with research, content development, and data analysis, it should never replace ethical reporting, fact-checking, accuracy, and human accountability. The discussions also explored the pressure faced by young journalists and media students in balancing technological advancement with the core principles of responsible journalism. Participants encourage fellow students and media practitioners to embrace innovation responsibly while remaining committed to truth, transparency, and professional standards that safeguard the credibility of the media industry. The engagement also provided students with a platform to openly share their experience, their challenges, and perspectives on how AI or artificial intelligence is reshaping journalism and the future of news reporting in Namibia. Let's now take a listen to that conversation that they had.
How do I word this? There are certain tools that you need, there are certain aspects that are required for you to be called a true journalist. Yeah. We depend on the code of ethics that are applied to us, but when it comes to AI, that is solely artificial. It doesn't have that human tone to it. So artificial intelligence, the application of it has been questionable, especially among students. The concerns have been raised by the lecturers and the community at large.
Okay. Well put. Now we come back to...
Okay, so I use ChatGPT.
Okay.
But I mainly use ChatGPT for simplifying and just getting ideas.
Okay.
And also the other tool I use is like Perplexy AI because it gives you, when you like search for information, it gives you sources with it. So yeah.
Okay. Which is especially as a student, it's very important to note your sources and also maybe for your research part of studying. Mm-hmm. Has a little pony?
I personally use Copilot and ChatGPT as well, as mentioned by Stacey. Generally, just because sometimes I sit with a lot of ideas, and so I don't necessarily have time to sit and draft these ideas manually. So I put, because there's also a voice feature on ChatGPT, I would then use this voice feature to just insert whatever ideas that I have and help it just basically help me come up with like a structure on how I'm supposed to do the writing for the assignment or the specific work that I'm supposed to do. But like I said, I don't necessarily entirely depend on AI to get the final output. I do my own research.
And I would then like to just...
News bits.
Okay.
Sports, it's more focused on patterns and it's more focused on factual data because it is sports, it happens, it is live streamed everywhere and this is actually factual data that AI that is open to news bits.
Okay.
You can do and use AI to do that,
yeah.
Right? You're taking away from what a journalist can do. systems and stuff like this to in turn help us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as I had mentioned, AI definitely is used for human intelligence automation, right? So you cannot replace what a human being can do and use AI to do that,
yeah.
right? You're taking away from what a journalist can do. Mm-hmm. You get what I'm saying? So different beats, I feel like in all beats, yes, you can use AI for research and for structuring your statements and stuff like that. And also that it can help you to relieve on the repetitive tasks that humans would rather, intern would have to do if AI was not existent, right?
Yeah.
But I believe in all practice, journalism should be taken as a an accurate practice, right? So you need to be truthful, you need to be honest and uphold all the principles of the practice in itself. So I don't think you should use AI.
Okay.
Yeah.
Investigative journalism, those require like human experience. So it is hard to like use AI on those because it's human experience and AI cannot relate to that. So, okay. Yeah.
Okay. Related to, I would want to know then from your work when it comes.
Because it should serve as an extension. We should not be solely relying on artificial intelligence. Because, like my colleagues have stated earlier, it has data that has been collected all around the world.
Yeah.
Now, when we talk about issues that are happening, especially nationally here, like issues that we have as a country here, AI might not deliver accurate results because the data might not have been entered. Yeah. We have real life situations that are going on. And that requires that human touch that AI can never replace.
Yeah.
We also need to remember that we human beings are the ones that developed artificial intelligence just to serve as an extension to our ideologies and the work that we want to do. So solely depending on AI and the results that AI, the result that AI is producing is, you know, it's an issue.
Okay.
It's an issue.
Salma?
As Lauren said, Some of the investigative journalism that we journalists have to do require a human touch, require you to be on the scene. Now, you are writing a story about Okahanja, and you're writing maybe something happened in Okahanja, and now you are giving AI to say, no, write this. Okahanja is a town that is 45 kilometers away from Veduk. This is what you must write. So now, I feel like AI, it doesn't give Namibian context. It's more based on global data. It will give you USA things because it is more based on that. Because I would say it's their robot, not ours. But it does, yes, inform the public if incorrectly used. And it doesn't give Namibian context based, if I can say. It does give, but not factual Namibian context based.
Okay. Hassel Alponi?
One of the major things, or rather the major principles in journalism is maintaining credibility, right? That is one of the most important things and something that we cannot overlook. So when it comes to using tools like ChatGPT or AI, yes, it's okay to use when you're brainstorming and coming up with ideas, but to solely rely on it for journalism is entirely wrong. Because you would want to be trusted as a news source or as a publishing entity or whatever. You would want your people, your audiences to trust that the news that you have published is credible enough to state that there is truth in what you have reported. Journalism is not supposed to rely on AI, or journalists rather are not supposed to rely on AI, because there needs to be credibility when you're publishing a story, right? And when you use AI, just like mentioned before, it used global data. So it might not even be relevant for the story that you're publishing. In journalism, we need to ensure that the news is relevant, prominent, and all these other things, right? And credibility is on the top of the chart, right? So we have to ensure that the news that we publish is credible. And when we use AI, how then do we say, contradict ourselves and say that the news is actually credible, but we've actually used AI? And one thing I've also realized in my studies is when I try to put all my notes, I can have, like, for example, 200 slides, and I have 2 or 3 days to study for an exam, let's say. And I put all of these notes in ChatGPT, and I tell it to make it concise for me. It will concise to the point of 2 sentences. And I don't need that. That will not help me pass an exam. So credibility is very important in the practice of journalism.
Okay. That is a very strong point. Stacey?
Authenticity and that human, most beat writing, or if, let me say, we can all tell if somebody used AI to report or write a story. So I feel like we should like avoid using AI because it loses, like work loses its authenticity and that human feel and emotions. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's all I can add to what they have said.
I think I'm loving the point. Strong thing because it ties the points that you've brought out to us today are very strong. At some point, Salma mentioned brain development, which is very true, because you're no longer allowing your brain to think for itself, and the brain needs to do that. The neurons need to burn for it to actually broaden itself. So I'm loving this discussion because it's helping us look at certain aspects. We have definitely looked at AI as this beautiful tool, and that it is in many aspects of our lives, but we need to consider the tools that we're using from both perspectives and understand how they fit into what it is that we need and whether it is actually necessary for where we're at a particular given time. As we're rounding off our session, I would like to give you all the opportunity to... Stacey?
I would like to say, I think journalism is truth and accountability. So if we use AI properly, authenticity in journalism can remain.
Okay.
I believe AI literacy is very important. We need to know what type of tools that we're using and for what specific purposes that the tools are used for, so that we can, so we avoid things like using content generally just created by AI and using it as our final work. I cannot stress that enough. Yeah, I just, for real.
Salma?
Journalism is a practice of finding and gathering information, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all in all, I'm still going to stand on AI cannot replace journalism, but AI is a supporting tool to help journalism, but cannot replace it. And I feel like moving forward, as students, as journalists that are already in their field and are doing their job perfectly, I believe that we should keep the integrity and we should be factual about what we are reporting on, and we should not lose the credibility of reporting by being blindsided by AI.
Mm.
Thank you.
Lawrence.
Right. At some point, the students that are sitting here are going to be the ones leading newsrooms.
Mm.
So we need to tackle the issue from where it begins in order for us to ensure that we uphold the integrity of newsrooms. In order for news houses to remain credible, we need, because this issue is stemming from, you know, at the base where we are right now in school. Students are solely depending on AI for the results, and that is going to affect them in the long run. Mm-hmm. So we need to properly find a way on how to give proper lessons on how to apply artificial intelligence, especially to our academic work.
Yeah.
That will ensure that the journalists that we have in the future are credible and they know how to do their job without solely relying on artificial intelligence itself. Remember, journalism also needs sources, and artificial intelligence cannot provide that. So you need to be in the field. You need to get your hands dirty. You need to get the news from credible sources in order to ensure that this news is actually factual before you publish it. So we need to find a way to have artificial intelligence lessons being given to students, be it at universities or even on school level, because the kids are also coming up here. We need to ensure that we need to teach them the right way and how to apply artificial intelligence.
I like the last point there, class or module specifically. Let us not lose ourselves. For now, though,
we need to ensure that this news is actually factual before you publish it. So we need to find a way to have artificial intelligence lessons being given to students, be it at universities or even on school level, because the kids are also coming up here. We need to ensure that we need to teach them the right way and how to apply artificial intelligence.
I like the last point there, starting it from the roots. We don't even need to wait for them to reach university. I think it's one of those.
No, it comes, no, when, when it comes to use of artificial intelligence or AI in journalism work, or for let me specifically speak on journalism work itself. I've noticed there's quite some concerns and some worries and some hype regarding that. But one thing we should not forget is that AI can't give out what you don't, it just can't automatically come up with things. Now, there's also some perhaps worries and concerns to say it will replace lots of work. But quite frankly, AI cannot interview a grieving mother in Kathutura. They say, for instance, there's news about a woman that lost her children in an accident. It can't go there and interview that particular woman and get information, you know, and then accurately or give it out to people. And it can't cultivate a police source. So it gives what it is fed. And therefore, it's about us also and how we actually use it. For instance, if you have a report, a comprehensive report, and you wrote it down, obviously, and then you give it into, you put it into ChatGPT, and you ask ChatGPT to probably reconstruct it and identify some, just properly align the grammar, sort of like how Grammarly does that, you know, how the Grammarly app also deals with grammar. Then I really don't see anything wrong with that, because technology is here for our benefits, for us, so that we may utilize it and benefit from it. It's almost as if, I think the hype is also because we are in a technological era where everybody has a voice and they can easily use their voice as a tool and can easily as opposed to traditional media where they can only speak when they're perhaps invited on television, or can only air their contributions and opinions when they are invited on radio. Now it's the opposite. They can just take their phone, record themselves with on WhatsApp, on Facebook, on TikTok, on Instagram, wheresoever, whatever platform that they desire, or YouTube that they desire to use, and then address certain issues. Because of that very particular reason, I think that is one of the reasons why I would attribute to the hype around it, because a lot of people have worries and concerns, and some have worries to say AI will replace our jobs. And I don't think that could, if it's going to happen in the future, I don't think it's happening even anytime soon, because hey, there needs to be practical work that needs to be done. Then work, even work needs to be thoroughly checked, thoroughly, you know, scrutinized for correctness and all that. And obviously we can't rely entirely on AI. For instance, it's very bad at writing essays. Yeah, that's one thing for sure. Hence why students will definitely get caught with that. And universities have become very wise, or they're wise. They have tools that detect AI work. So even students who are using it for their work will get penalized in the long term. And if they continue to use it over and over and again, the consequences could be dire, could be suspension from school. But then again, really coming back to say, the use of AI, and even with when they use it for essays and references, some of the references or some of the sources might not exist, and therefore that's how it becomes obvious that this was. And it's quite a little bit quite, especially for a writer and for a reader, it's quite easy to detect that this might not have been your work. The use of the grammar that was used, you don't seem to really have this particular type of knowledge on how to, not necessarily type of knowledge, but it just looks like this was not really written by a person themselves, you know, some sort of, but nonetheless it's good for grammar corrections and for just properly articulating something. And there is a need, of course, to still go through that and scrutinize, but to completely bash it out and say, let not the students use it, then I think or any workers, for instance, employees or journalists, not to use it at all, I think that's being too extremist. It's almost as if you saying, let's not use Google, for instance. Let's not use Firefox. Let's not use, you know, let's not use Microsoft. Let's not use it at all. And that would mean, what then is the purpose of all these tools, of this advancement in internet, in technology? What's the purpose of it then if we can't make use of it? So I think it's quite a critical discussion that needs to be held, and both sides need to be weighed in the balance and see what really is the benefit. Where do we draw the line? Where do we draw the angle? From which angle do we take it from? But it needs to be thoroughly scrutinized until we get to that really level of where we can say, okay, based on understanding from this perspective and based on understanding from the other perspective, then we put this together and see which benefit, which one has more benefits and whether the benefits weigh out to the other one. So that's quite necessary. And therefore, I really think at this point, I would say we can't dismiss AI at all and say, no, it shouldn't be used. It is an advancement. And yes, it needs to be wisely used. There are side effects. Side effects is with the animals and the humans, but there are adverse effects, sort of like to say to that. There are bedsides or negative effects to eat, especially when it comes to generating content that looks very real, but it's not authentic. Or using AI pictures, for instance, in journalism, AI pictures, generated AI pictures. And if you look so closely and you scrutinize quite closely, you'll be able to tell and recognize that, but this is AI. Something about it just doesn't look real and doesn't at all. And then, and from what I've heard, there is growing need for scholars, educators to really want they let there be some sort of way where if an image was used to using AI, let it be said so that people are not confused, you know, so that people are not tricked, perhaps I could say tricked for lack of a better word. People are not tricked to think this is a real photo, but when it's really not, let it be put there that this was AI generated. And I personally feel, don't really like AI pictures. I mean, we have cameras, we have even cell phones now that can take pictures. Why are we relying on AI pictures? Why not just use real pictures? Even companies nowadays use AI photos for advertisement. And you ask yourself, wait, we have creativity. And if we're talking about creative industry, we want to somewhat promote that. We want to not just speak about promoting it, but in our actions, really promote it and really use the creative industry, not for them to use AI photos, which somehow just questions the credibility also of that work or the company's work and all that, because it doesn't give quite a nice picture. But all in all, before we even draw any conclusions, it is necessary to educate ourselves on the pros and the cons of AI, and then we can draw the conclusion. But I definitely at this point will say we can't completely phrase it out and say, no, let's not use it at all, because it's beneficial. Just like when Google came into picture or into enforcement, I'm sure people appreciate that. Therefore, I believe with this advancement also, it's necessary for us to appreciate it. Nonetheless, this is On The Reading News Analysis. 083-288-401 is the number in studio. Please call up and join in studio. That being said, let's pause right here. Let's take a trip to the marketplace and we'll be back shortly. Stay tuned.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the eye. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Ipurane ngelo wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweko tete okoye ekukulile. Oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano ile koshuana. Onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwa tafano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kumberewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. And now for economic indicators before we get into news beyond the borders of Namibia. US dollar today is equal to 16 Namibian dollars, 0.32 cents. One Australian dollar is equal to 11 Namibian dollars, 0.84 cents. One euro is equal to 19 Namibian dollars, 0.20 cents. One United Arab Emirates dirham is equal to 4 Namibian dollars, 0.44 cents. £1 sterling is equal to 22 Namibian dollars, 0.22 cents. One Botswana pula is equal to 1 Namibian dollar, 0.22 cents. And finally, one Chinese yuan is equal to 2 Namibian dollars, 0.40 cents. And now for news beyond the borders of Namibia. Now, as usual, we always start off regionally, move over to continental news. Thereafter, international news comes your way. Let's start off in South Africa concerning Minister of Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana, who puts Joburg on notice for transgressions.
Governance expert Professor Alex van der Heffer from the Wits School of Governance. Prof van der Heffer, good evening. Thank you so much for your time. Really do appreciate it. It's really scathing for a municipality to have the fundamentals so badly wrong, to overestimate its revenue collection, to understate its expenditure line items, and to effectively not balance the book and to pass a budget that is underfunded and unfunded. Of course, that will leave the city of Johannesburg in a perilous and precarious situation financially should it go ahead fully with this budget. Critical services won't be executed. Did the minister do the right thing in this instance, or did the minister wait too long to intervene?
Well, I think this is very late in the day in coming. What you're seeing is an accumulation of financial problems over a very long period of time, because one of the issues that is raised is the 25 billion rand in essentially unpaid debts, which is essentially an historical deficit that still has to be covered, most of which is owed to Eskom and the rest to Rand Water and then a bunch to contractors. So that is already a deficit. But what's being pointed out, which is a failure to comply with the Municipal Finance Management Act, in which they are actually budgeting expenditure which doesn't actually have revenue backing it up. So they're unfunded. This includes the wage settlement that has been agreed to, in which there was absolutely no revenue for it. I mean, there isn't even the revenue to pay the debts of the municipality. But the minister is also pointing out governance failures. So the historical tendency to have persistent and ongoing irregular expenditure and other forms of financial mismanagement, which is it is the duty of the accounting officers in the various public entities at the municipality, but in the metro itself, they have to prevent and avoid and deal with. But it looks like they're fudging the budget. They're not producing real budget figures that you can bank on and rely on in any financial year. And that is the essence of what the minister is stating. But he's also giving a warning. He's basically saying, we're going to take, there's an amount that is transferred from national government to all municipalities, the municipal equitable share allocation. This is usually allocated every year. They're going to withhold that to be able to pay off creditors. That's one threat that has been indicated in the letter. And the other one is quite simply administration. And so a letter like this is clearly a final warning. And what it appears is that the mayor and the city have just not responded to the kinds of issues that need to be addressed to kind of pull this city back into shape.
Alex, this is happening all while the city of Johannesburg has not released audited financial statements for the financial year 2024-2025. They long passed the due date, so much so that the Johannesburg Stock Exchange had delisted the bonds of the city of Johannesburg that had been listed there. I spoke to the CFO in the city of Johannesburg, and he said to me, well, that's because there's a dispute in the audit findings between the city as well as the Auditor General. The Auditor General has not signed off, and they're still trying to debate and come to some sort of a middle ground on some of those audit findings. They say it's very technical in its nature, and it's got nothing to do with fruitless or wasteful expenditure or mismanagement of finances altogether, and that it's a technical accounting assessment that they're effectively having a contention about. Given that, and given the letter of the Minister of Finance, is there enough for the provincial minister or for the provincial MEC of cooperative governance to consider taking the city of Johannesburg under administration? We've never seen a metro taken under administration. This would be the first. Is there enough for that?
Well, I think that this is the kind of, so first of all, it looks from the figures as if the municipality is effectively bankrupt. It survives purely on essentially borrowed money, so to speak, which it's not meant to be doing. It's financially not viable, and its revenue collections are not stable. And its expenditure is increasing under those circumstances, so it doesn't actually match its revenue to its expenditure. So it's in a debt spiral, a financial debt spiral. So this does suggest that there is a need for a serious intervention. But an intervention has to come in. If you were looking at a company in liquidation or a company that has to be managed, you'd have to come in and you'd have to change the leadership and take hold of the reins of the key parts of this city and restructure it and get it right. But the audit, the fact that there is a fight with the Auditor General is extremely worrying, because that is the external auditor of the metro. And why the Auditor General will be insisting on a certain audit framework, a certain accounting framework and representation of the accounts, is because they're meant to represent the true financials of the Metro. And if there's disagreement, it means there's disagreement over how they're representing the financials. And part of the problem that we're seeing is that they appear to be misrepresenting their financials over time.
Yeah.
So those are very serious issues, and they suggest we can't rely on what's going on.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to leave it here. Professor van der Heffer, thank you so much for your time. Really do appreciate it. Governance expert Alex van der Heffer from the Wits School of Governance. Or for the Provincial MEC of Cooperative Governance to consider taking the city of Johannesburg under administration. We've never seen a metro taken under administration. This would be the first. Is there enough for that?
Well, I think that this is the kind of... So, first of all, it looks from the figures as if the municipality is effectively bankrupt. It survives purely on essentially borrowed money, so to speak, which it's not meant to be doing. It's financially not viable, and its revenue collections are not stable. And its expenditure is increasing under those circumstances, so it doesn't actually match its revenue to its expenditure. So it's in a debt spiral, a financial debt spiral. So this does suggest that there is a need for a serious intervention, but an intervention has to come in. If you were looking at a company in liquidation or a company that has to be managed, you'd have to come in and you'd have to change the leadership and take hold of the reins of the key parts of this city and restructure it and get it right. But the audit, the fact that there is a fight with the Auditor General is extremely worrying, because that is the external auditor of the Metro. And why the Auditor General will be insisting on a certain audit framework, a certain accounting framework and representation of the accounts, is because they're meant to represent the true financials of the Metro. And if there's disagreement, it means there's disagreement over how they're representing the financials. And part of the problem that we're seeing is that they appear to be misrepresenting their financials over time.
Yeah.
So those are very serious issues, and they suggest we can't rely on what's going on.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to leave it here. Professor van der Heffer, thank you so much for your time. Really do appreciate it. Governance expert Alex van der
Heffer. And now in other news, the Falafala case, Concord is set to rule on the matter on Friday.
Well, to this now, South Africa's apex court, the Constitutional Court, will rule on an application brought by the EFF and the African Transformation Movement against Parliament's blocking of an impeachment inquiry by voting down a Section 89 panel report that found President Ramaphosa had a serious case to answer. For analysis on this, we're joined by political analyst Professor Sam Koma and constitutional law analyst Advocate Lufuno Novondwe. Advocate Novondwe, I want to start the conversation with you. The separation of powers is a very interesting doctrine in that it safeguards the integrity of the different arms of state, even if it doesn't necessarily like the actions of a different arm of state. To crystallize that even further, you have the right to vote even if you vote badly. And one may argue that Parliament voted badly in the Section 89 report. What is the test that the Constitutional Court will be applying tomorrow in determining whether or not that vote was valid?
Yes, it's going to be a very difficult test, because we, like you have said, we have a separation of powers in a constitutional democracy. And that separation of powers gives Parliament the power to decide on this matter. Remember, this matter was decided on a vote, and there was a majority vote, which was in favor of the Section 89 panel report, which found that there was a prima facie evidence that President Cyril Ramaphosa may have violated his oath of office and the Constitution. So, in other words, the majority has voted against that, which then means that the process of impeachment might not even start, or in fact, that vote block that impeachment process. So the question which will be before court on Friday will be whether that process, which was followed by Parliament, was that process in line with the Constitution? Was that process in line with the parliamentary rules? Whether is there any violation of the Constitution or violation of the rules in terms of the conduct of the members of the Parliament when they exercise their powers or their wish in terms of the Section 89 panel report, which was not voted in favor of by the majority of parliamentarians.
Yeah. I want to bring you into the conversation because I think it's an important question politically to make sense of Professor Sam Koma. And that is, when the Section 89 panel report initially came out and said that the president has a case to answer, it was so scathing, and of course the gravity of it was far-reaching, that there were rumors within the corridors of the ANC and the union buildings that President Cyril Ramaphosa was preparing to step down as the president of the country. And that, of course, sent the country into a frenzy. The markets reacted in a disconcerted way. And we know that there were last-minute 11th-hour meetings that were happening with senior leadership in the ANC then. That's how serious the Section 89 panel report finding was then. How serious, then, do you think the Constitutional Court ruling could be on Friday?
Yes, so just to also pick up on what my colleague expressed around the issue of the doctrine of separation of powers. So we know that the Constitutional Court cannot order the National Assembly to adopt the Section 89 report. At most, the Constitutional Court is likely to make a determination whether the resolution which was made by the National Assembly in December 2022 was rational and also constitutional, or not rational and also therefore unconstitutional, because that is basically the legal challenge that the EFF joined by the ATM has brought to the Constitutional Court, to say the Constitutional Court has to make a ruling determining the constitutionality of the impeachment rule that empowers the National Assembly to retain its discretion whether to proceed to adopt the panel report or not. And we know it is common cause that in December 2022, the National Assembly resolved to reject the adoption of the report. So on Friday, this is what I think the scenarios are likely to play out. If the Constitutional Court rules in favor of the EFF and also the ATM, will this seventh parliament proceed to adopt the Section 89 report? Two, will there be an appetite on the part of the GNU parties, 11 in number, to proceed to adopt the Section 89 report? And also the third point is that even if the Constitutional Court were to order Parliament to initiate or institute impeachment proceedings against the President, will the EFF and the ATM pull through a two-thirds majority voting support to remove the sitting President in the event the ad hoc committee or the Section 89 committee finds against the President? But also it is important to indicate that this matter, as we have previously argued, it has become moot in the sense that you have three state institutions that have since made a determination around this particular matter, namely the South African Reserve Bank that has cleared wrongdoing on the part of the President in terms of breaking foreign exchange rules. And two, you have the public protector that has since cleared the President from breaching the executive ethics code. And finally, we now have the IPED report that has since been classified. And it remains to be seen
whether it will be declassified and
yeah.
what is in the report for us to make a sense of what are the findings.
Yeah, Prof Koma, I do want to point out, though, that all those bodies were asking a different question from one another. Similarly, so did the Section 89 report pertaining to the oversight work of Parliament and not necessarily of the others. But I do want to touch on a point of mootness that you're making there. And I want to bring you back into the conversation, Advocate Nevondwe, to ask this question. Can the Constitutional Court hold the 7th Administration Parliament accountable for the work of the 6th Administration Parliament, as it were, given that these things happened and the Section 89 panel report happened before the 2024 general elections, right? And that is to say that a different parliamentary body, should it have failed in its oversight duty, would have failed then, and we're now talking about an entirely brand new parliament with different members carrying a different mandate.
Accountability applies all over. It doesn't matter whether it's a 6th administration, whether it's a 7th administration. Parliament must hold the executive accountable. That is their responsibilities. That is their role. So remember, the role of the Constitutional Court is very clear here. The Constitutional Court must be able to determine, because this judgment will set a precedent for the legal weight of Section 89 panel findings and the limitations of parliamentary discretion in impeachment cases. So I do not think that whether it happened in the 6th administration, now we are now in the 7th administration, it won't matter. It is still the role of Parliament to hold the executive accountable, and in that Parliament has exercised its powers in the 6th administration when there was the vote. Now the question is to say, was that processes? That is the question. And if the answer is yes, then it means that this matter will be resolved. If the answer is no, it means that there might be a decision for the reconsideration of the processes from beginning.
Well, we're gonna have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time and your insights this evening. Really do appreciate it. Advocate Lufuno Novondwe, as well as Professor Sam Koma, talking to us there on the Palapala judgment coming out Friday morning in the Constitutional Court. We're going to take a short break. We'll continue on the other side of this.
In other news, South Africa begins stone fruit exports to China under the new trade protocol.
African Delight and Ruby Star. These are the plum varieties that are now destined for the Chinese market, after South Africa signed a stone fruit trade protocol with China. The deal is seen as a major boost for the local agricultural sector, and is expected to boost investment through the agricultural value chain. South Africa has already exported its first shipment of plums to China, and the deal allows the country to export a variety of stone fruits.
20,000 plums right at the tail end of our season was exported to China, and that offered us an opportunity to test the market. And the kind of feedback that we got from China is that they're very happy about the quality of the product, and we are hoping and anticipating that in the next season, when we have full production of all the varieties of all types of fruit stones, stone fruits will certainly be able to export more.
Much of the plums that are exported are produced in the Western Cape, where the agricultural sector is the second highest employer of unskilled labor. From transport to logistics and pack sheds to packing, the deal with China has the potential to unlock significant sums in export value. It is job creation on farms that will be a significant contributor.
Get top scores. Yes, marathon savings at USave. Rexona Shield Roll-On Deodorant, $22.99. 8 Karas Sanitary Pads, just $6.99. 500 Milli Nuden Pine Gel Surface Cleaner, $24.99. 2 Kilo Bag Surf Hand Washing Powder, only $49.99. And Dry Nips Premium Disposable Nappies, just $139.99. Hurry to your favorite. USave.
To the local agricultural sector, with new investment across the value chain expected through the Stone Fruit Trade Protocol. And the deal also allows South Africa to diversify its exports beyond traditional markets and unlock significant economies of scale in the Chinese market.
I think this is really a breakthrough moment for South Africa's stone fruit industry. China is one of the largest fruit markets in the world, and access to that market is a major growth opportunity. And I think very importantly, it means that we can diversify our export markets, and that, you know, reduces the reliance on traditional destinations such as the EU and the UK.
For now, other stone fruits such as peaches, nectarines, apricots and prunes are also expected to be exported to China once the harvest season gets underway. Travis Andrews, CGTN, Cape Town.
Liberty Kenya Holdings post revenue growth but faces profitability pressure.
Welcome back to the program. Let's focus on insurance in East Africa. Liberty Kenya Holdings returned an 8% rise in revenue for the 4 year ending in December 2025. The firm is attributing that surge to strong performance in both the life and general insurance categories in a country where insurance penetration does tend to be relatively low. Over the year, however, Liberty saw pressure on profitability. Group profit profits before tax, rather, fell by around 47% to about $8.5 million, mainly due to higher claims in motor, medical, fire and group life segments, as well as normalized investment returns after a blockbuster year in 2024. Looking ahead, though, the firm does say it's well positioned for growth in 2026, backed by a pretty strong capital base, an expanding distribution network and diversified products. Let's bring in the Group CEO of Liberty Kenya Holdings, Kieran Godden, who's joining us in the studio tonight. Thank you for your time this evening.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with a broad picture here, because, you know, looking at the insurance sector in general and then drilling down, because gross premium payments across the sector in life and general insurance, double-digit growth last year, 25%, 13% respectively. How do we square that with the fact that households' disposable income has been under an enormous amount of pressure?
So I think there's a few factors. In the life insurance industry in particular, there's been a shift away potentially from asset managers managing pension solutions to the life insurance companies. Mm-hmm. Really what I think consumers are looking for is the smooth or guaranteed type returns that the insurance companies can offer them. Mm-hmm. I also think the penetration in insurance is pretty low as a percentage of GDP. Mm-hmm. So it's coming off a low base. And people, I think, are starting to appreciate the value of insurance through initiatives like financial education and so on.
And the medical insurance side of the business, to me, looks quite interesting, because looking at Heritage's number, they had the third highest insurance service results in the sector in 2024. Did that trend continue in 2025? And how are you managing to keep your loss ratios well below the industry average, which is 97%, at least in 2024, but your number came in at around 75% that year?
So 2025 was a harder year. So claims did go up. We recognized that. We had, as you said, we had a blockbuster year in 2024, so we were always expecting a tougher year. Mm-hmm. The cost base is key, and there you have to make sure you have a great relationship with your partners, mm-hmm. particularly your medical service providers in your hospitals, to manage them well and make sure that they have a sustainable business model like we do. Mm-hmm. And then, as you said, it's about managing costs, and we're investing quite heavily in technology to make sure we can keep our cost base as sane as possible across that piece of the business.
And you're moving towards trying to segment the medical insurance space, as I understand it, because right now, if I go to my broker and I just buy medical insurance, it's a sort of one-size-fits-all vanilla product, but you're trying to segment it
by stages that would appeal a bit more to kids, something specialized more towards an older demographic? Walk me through that.
So traditionally, we've had medical insurance targeted at the sort of adult employed population. Mm. So my generation is the first one that has to take care of both its children and its parents.
Yeah. The sandwich generation, as it were.
So what we're looking at is to make sure there's an appropriate solution both for children, and we're there focusing on institutions, schools, and so on, mm-hmm. and then to enable older people to get more predictable cover when they really need it the most, because that's when they come under pressure. Mm-hmm. So those are the solutions we're looking at. And what we've done is rather than just focus on kind of a broad brush approach for everyone, mm-hmm. we try to use the data that we have, which is significant, to target in the right kind of benefit set for the right kind of solutions.
Yeah, because I mean, kids, my nieces, my nephews, they're always running around. You've got a whole bunch of upper respiratory tract infections that they always have to deal with on a regular basis. But the sort of healthcare needs for the older demographic, you're dealing with non-communicable diseases, lifestyle diseases in some cases, that their needs are completely different, mm-hmm. right?
So these are fundamentally different sectors, and that's why you need targeted solutions to address the needs of those particular parts of the population. And as you said, the senior citizens where you've got chronic diseases and where medical care or health care and health cover becomes crucial, it's vital to get that right. And using the data, what we're aiming to do is to build a sustainable solution. So the predictable premium pricing in exchange for coverage of the unpredictable events.
Is it a general insurance industry perception that, you know, that older demographic is just, it's a little hard to insure, to provide sustainable cover for them? Because as someone who's been in the markets trying to look for cover for people, you know, over 65 and so on and so forth, it's been really challenging, right, to get cover for that older demographic. But is it a lack of data on what their actual health needs are that sort of keeps insurance firms away from that and then raises premiums for everybody else?
I think it's partly that. Mm-hmm. I think people don't price it appropriately. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is what happens is the earlier you buy the coverage, the better.
Yeah.
So by the time someone is sick or by the time someone is in their 80s, you're reaching a point where it's too late. So we're really encouraging our customers to, as they transition out of employment, to take up the senior citizen cover or the continuation of cover, mm-hmm. because then they have coverage for that entire period. That makes it more sustainable and more predictable.
Okay, one last question for you in terms of expanding the reach of your products, because with digital channels, you know, the marginal cost of onboarding an extra client is essentially quite small. But what's the strategy moving forward? Continue with the bank assurance strategy you have now with Stanbic Bank? Can you add more banks into that network, or are you going to be doubling down on your own digital distribution network?
So our bank assurance strategy is wider than Stanbic. So Stanbic obviously is a core partner of ours, but we have great relationships with all of the large banks, and we do some wonderful business to support them and their clients. Mm-hmm. For us, the digital channels at this point, it's more around digital fulfillment, mm-hmm. being able to make it easier for customers to do business with us, mm-hmm. rather than seeking for digital selling. Mm-hmm. So I think in the insurance space, digital selling itself hasn't quite taken off, mm-hmm. But you need to be positioned for when that
because
switch
clients
happens.
Prefer talking to a person rather than looking for a product on the machine.
That is my sense, but they then want it to be easy. Mm. So that the advisor wants it to be easy, the customer wants it to be easy. They don't want to have to fill in forms, go for medical underwriting and so on. The easier it is, the faster that they can do it, the better it becomes for them, the happier the experience.
Okay, we'll leave it there for the time being. Kieran Gooden, Group CEO, Liberty Canyon Holdings. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
For many people, access to everyday goods in Sudan is becoming increasingly uncertain. New restrictions on imports are limiting the flow of products into local markets, as authorities attempt to curb demand for foreign currency and stabilize the economy. Officials say the measures are necessary to reduce pressure on the Sudanese pound and encourage local industries. But in a country heavily reliant on imports, the impact is already being felt across several sectors. Traders say supply chains, already disrupted by insecurity and transport challenges, are now facing additional pressure. Delays, reduced stock, and rising costs are becoming more common, particularly for food, consumer goods, and industrial supplies.
These restrictions are making it harder for us to bring in goods. Prices are already high, and now supply is becoming less predictable. Customers are struggling, and so are we.
Sudan has faced repeated shortages of essential goods since the conflict began in 2023. According to the World Bank, after 2 years of significant economic contraction, the Sudanese economy picked up a little in 2025 with minor growth, but inflation is still very high at 68% year-on-year in December 2024, and many households are seeing their purchasing power decline. Economists warn that, while the restrictions may ease pressure on foreign currency reserves, they could also contribute to further price increases in local markets.
The Sudanese government's ban on importing certain non-essential goods such as processed milk, baked goods, leather and handicrafts could boost local production and entrepreneurship. It may also reduce demand for foreign currency amid ongoing economic pressures. The move is strategically sound and could help stabilize the exchange rate. However, long-term recovery will require deeper structural reforms to address trade imbalances and support sustainable growth.
Businesses that depend on imported materials are among the hardest hit. Many are struggling to maintain operations as access to supplies becomes more limited and unpredictable. For consumers, the concern is immediate. Fears of additional shortages and rising living costs are growing as economic pressures continue to mount. While authorities aim to stabilize the economy and support local production, challenges remain significant. Ongoing conflict, disrupted transport routes, and limited access to foreign currency continue to complicate recovery efforts.
As Sudan tightens import restrictions, the balance between economic stabilization and market stability remains uncertain, with businesses and consumers bracing for further pressure in the months ahead. Neba Muhiddin, CGTN, Port Sudan.
Meanwhile, Tanzania's standard gauge railway ushers in modern rail era.
Tanzania operates East Africa's first electrified standard gauge railway, a project aimed at transforming how people and goods move across the country. Two of the six planned phases are complete. The government says it has now secured funding for most of the remaining sections.
Funding for phases 3 and 4 is in place, and phase 5 has also secured funding. Implementation now depends on contractor progress. The funds are ready.
With speeds of up to 160 kilometers per hour and fares averaging around $15 between Dar es Salaam and the capital Dodoma, the railway is increasingly drawing new passengers.
Fuel prices have affected our economy, so now you can take the train instead of driving. It makes things much easier.
It saves a lot of time. By bus it takes about 8 hours, but with the SGR it's about 4 to 5 hours. It's very convenient. We really enjoy it.
As of April 2026, Tanzania has invested more than $10 billion in the railway, which upon completion will span just over 2,500 kilometers in total. Authorities say a recent $2.3 billion financing deal will support upcoming phases, while regional development partners are expected to back additional sections, with China Civil Engineering Construction Corporation handling parts of the construction.
For the past 21 months, Tanzania's standard gauge railway has carried more than 5.5 million passengers between Dar es Salaam and the capital Dodoma, about 9,000 people each day. While that's still small compared to the tens of millions traveling by road annually, the SGR's speed and reliability are steadily shifting commuter preferences.
After years of funding challenges, the project is now gaining momentum. But economists warn that rising revenues must eventually balance the cost of borrowing.
Only financing is not an issue.
But how are they going to refund the money and repay the loans? Because we still have a lot of other issues to deal with when it comes to health sectors, education sectors, and other sectors such as agriculture and the rest.
With a projected freight capacity of up to 10,000 tons, the government aims to increase the rail's share of cargo from just 2% to 30% by 2030, easing pressure on roads and improving efficiency at the port of Dar es Salaam. Officials say the railway will play a key role in boosting regional trade, aligning with Africa's broader ambitions to improve connectivity and reduce transport costs. Isaac Lukando, CGTN, Dar es Salaam.
And that now brings us to the conclusion after this episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Onkona Nadingi program brought to you by Penny Ambiko Jonas, and thereafter the Home Run Show with Dwight and Helmut from 1600 hours. And don't forget the Business Economic Segment Show with David Shambe. From Indafa Happy Juju, it is goodbye.